Hi guys, and welcome to Health Tech Matters. Today our guest is Mark Kultus. He leads the user experience team at Benevolent AI, an AI drug discovery company. Over the past decade, Mark worked with two biotech unicorns. He designed products for clinical decision-making and reporting, for running clinical trials, and for portable DNA research. Interesting fact! He grew up in a family of medical doctors. When Mark was a kid, he loved browsing Atlas of Human Anatomy. Welcome to the podcast, Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me.
So just to start with, maybe you could tell me more a bit about your personal story, your career background.
I trained as an industrial designer and never went into industrial design career. Instead, I discovered UX along the way. I feel quite good here because it's a good blend of visual communication, ergonomics, and human factors and research, working with users, semantics involved in product building.
Right. And right now you're working at Benevolent AI.
Working at Benevolent AI. I'm director of user experience at Benevolent AI, leading a team of 5 people, product designers, user researchers.
Benevolent AI is quite a complex product. So maybe just by researching and trying to understand what it does, not everybody will understand what it does properly. So could you please give us more context about the product?
Yes, you're right. So at Benevolent AI, we're building a platform for drug discovery. So our goal is to understand complex biology and then discover new medicines as a result of deepening that understanding and exploring biomedical data. Drug discovery and development is a process of actually coming up with new medicines for patients. So end goal would be introducing new medicines to the world, to the patients who need them. Traditionally, drug discovery has been quite risky and expensive. So not many R&D projects in drug discovery would succeed. And that has been pushing the cost of those that do succeed up and those that would actually reach the market. And in addition to that, biology is incredibly complex and our understanding of it is incomplete, still poorly understood. So what we're doing is we're building a platform of products, tools, and models for AI drug discovery that enables scientists to navigate this complex data space in order to make unbiased, better informed, and data-driven decisions. And we've named that platform the Benevolent Platform.
Right.
Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, so the target user is a scientist, right? Scientist or
yes.
Doctor? Pharmacist?
No, not a doctor. The target user is drug discovery scientist or anyone involved in this early stage drug discovery process. We built this platform for our internal scientists. We have a team of 300 scientists and technologists building the platform together. Kind of going back to your initial question. So the platform that we're building is powerful computational research and development platform, and at its core sits our knowledge graph, which captures the interconnectivity of all relevant data and scientific literature. Scientists ask biological questions, they surface novel insight and triage hypotheses, everything to help in this drug discovery process that normally is very laborious and risky. You can think of the knowledge graph as a network of various biomedical entities, such as diseases, genes, cell types, molecules, clinical trials that are linked by known relationships, such as that gene is known to be involved in that disease. And then multiply this by millions of entities and millions of relationships between those entities. That's the knowledge that more user-facing products sit on.
Yeah, that's interesting because I actually had a chance and worked on knowledge graph in a different company, it's a medical robots company. They also had quite a complex infrastructure. I was not directly working on knowledge graph, but I had some understanding of it. And it is extremely complex and yeah, the learning curve is insane. That's what I want to say. So how do you feel about it? How much time did you had to spend and just understanding how the industry works, how this collaboration can work in the company?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not a sector or an industry that, you know, designers or user experience designers or anyone from user experience would normally train for. It requires our own design specific or research specific expertise, plus so much more related to the sector itself. So I've been working in bioinformatics contexts and on genomics projects, scientific projects for several years now, close to maybe 10 years now. So I've over time, I've got to know the data, technologies, how people think, what they do, what they try to achieve with the use of tools that they build themselves or they use and procure from third parties. It takes about 3 months to work out what we're doing when you join.
Quite a lot.
It's quite a lot. Yeah, it's quite a lot. It's a number of learning curves when in the first 2 weeks, you just allow your brain to swell and absorb, and then you think you got it. Then you realize you got it all wrong. So you need to relearn all of it. And then again, you realize that's not the way you understood it. Everyone goes through that learning curve because you always miss something from the important context.
Yeah, and just two questions raised in my mind. First of all, the platform should be secure. Second part, the people whom you are hiring, you are investing in them a lot. So like a person cannot invest the time and resources fully in the first 3 months because his or she is learning. And so you are making a bet. And it's quite a huge bet, I'd say, 3 months for every single person that joins the company. At least 3 months, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's right. When we were hiring our user experience team, I paid a lot of attention to how we recruit, to focus on the traits and skills that will be a good predictor of how well, you know, people will be able to find themselves working in a new environment.
For example,
some people in the team have some prior experience working in health tech, either on medical devices or software. Things that we've been looking for is ability to think critically, ability to look at data critically and interrogate data, ask questions, not take things for granted, ability to make right compromises, not to give up too soon, but also know when to let go in collaborations with people. The platform that we build it's not a consumer product. It's not going to be used by everyone everywhere. So we have certain definitions of good enough. And that means that where others, I guess, who build consumer products might say, we're not going to stop here because we're building for 10 million users across the globe. These are the areas where we might say, okay, it's good enough for us because we're building for a smaller population of users. There are areas where others would say, we don't need to go there because this is too much for a user. And we need to simplify as much as possible. And this is where we say, this is not good enough for us. We need to provide more and more and more because our users need that and they're asking for that. They benefit from that. So when we were recruiting, it was very important to gauge if we'll be able to collaborate in that way where you can say, okay, this is good enough. So we'll move on this one, but this is not good enough and we'll drill deeper and deeper. We can't go pixel perfect on what we're doing, but we'll drill to get data perfect. And it's a different balance of priorities. So that's what we were looking for when recruiting as well. One more thing that we were looking at is very specific soft skills. So excellent communication, both visual and verbal, because we do explain a lot of things to our colleagues in the process. Also written communication, attention to detail, ability to learn easily and quickly.
And how do you measure communication skills?
I don't think you can measure it.
That's why I'm asking.
We can judge it. We were asking in the recruitment process to present something visually in format as well. So describe how something's been developed, the rationale behind it, the design decisions, and then present it. It's a judgment call based on how complete the message is, also if you are allowing other points of view and listening to them and then building on top of them or adjusting your ideas to what others are saying. In our interviews, we've included user experience designers and researchers, but also product managers, engineers, scientists, to see how that communication might play out in a collaboration situation. So we had a sense of if a candidate is actually listening to what the bioinformatician has to say and why something wouldn't work in their design proposal, or you know, if the communication is just, this is my idea and I'm not listening to what others are saying and dismissing the critique from the expert.
Right. Maybe let's talk a bit about the product as a platform. So you mentioned that you want to drill deeper into specific features, specific parts of the product to make it better. But obviously, this derives a lot from the requests that you get from scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this work? How do you process this request? How do you prioritize them? How do you understand what is something that you want to dig deeper in and something that is good enough just like it is?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because there's so much that we can do to make this really long and complex process of drug discovery work better. We base our prioritization of what we're trying to achieve for the platform. This is driven by the product team. We look at what's important, what to prioritize, and where the biggest wins are to be made based on the capabilities of our system. We're trying to look at where we're going strategically and then decide to invest the resource.
So when you get the request, let's say feature request from a scientist, how does your team proceed to the next step?
I think it's fair to say that because of the fact that we're building a complex platform for discovery, that as we build it, we often get to appreciate the complexity of the challenge as we go. And that kind of dictates how much capacity we'll have for additional work that might pop up.
It's curious that you mentioned that for some complex projects, or feature requests, you cannot accurately understand how much time the development will take. So you allow yourself some time to just research the problem and then give more accurate deadlines for this.
We don't shy away from complex, challenging opportunities, but scientific domain, the things that you can research and plan and prepare for an estimate. I'm not sure if it's different than in compared to the development of other types of products.
I think what is different is communication and collaboration, because sometimes you do not have to collaborate that much with other team members. And especially if the project is complex, indeed, you have to collaborate a lot to understand the context. So maybe you have good practices in the company in regards to team collaboration. Maybe some meeting specific routines.
What we sometimes do, which is quite practical, is we let ourselves in the meetings and in collaboration with deep experts, the researchers, we give ourselves a license to ask stupid questions. And those questions are not really stupid. They are actually important questions, but they may seem silly in the room of people with PhDs. The questions can be used to validate if we are aligned, if we're on track. The biggest risk, I guess, communication-wise, would be to keep going, working as a team, not realizing that we've been talking about a different thing for so long. And then realizing only at the end, which is too late then.
So do you have general discovery workshops? If you get a request about a feature that you or maybe your team members do not quite understand very well, so you arrange a workshop as such, meeting, and you ask the people who can answer all these silly questions.
Yes, we do that. We do other things as well. We build quick prototypes to push the conversation forward, instant pushback straight away from someone who might be raising an idea. We run discovery workshop sessions. We repeatedly and regularly run contextual inquiry research sessions with our users. We involve our users in co-creation sessions as well. Sometimes we ask our users to sketch and then build on top of their ideas. Some of them are so wild and out there, we wouldn't be able as designers to even come up with these things. And those ideas come from the understanding, deeper understanding of the data. One of the reasons it's possible is our unique close proximity to our users who are internal. They, when we still worked in the office, they sit next to you. And mm-hmm. I guess that also comes with limitations, risks, because we've found that over time we kind of need to conserve user naivety. And that need comes from the fact that we need to balance it with ability to remove bias from our findings and maximize the credibility of the observations that we're making, for example, in situations when someone sees the product for the first time or a feature for the first time.
And do you create onboarding guides for these new features so that all 300 scientists can understand how it works? Let's say you're hiring a new scientist and he comes to the team and probably he sees a platform the first time. Do you have any kind of product guides that help them just to onboard to understand what is where? Apart from the training, obviously.
It's a very timely question, actually. We're trying to map this experience right now.
Okay, I see. That's interesting. And one question I couldn't help asking you is security and actually testing the product. Because obviously it's high risk and you should make the product that works properly. Otherwise, the results might be unpredictable. So how do you make sure that it's secure and safe to use?
Do you mean that the medicines that we might be coming to are safe for patients to use? Yeah. It's a very important question that we always keep at the top of our minds. No new medicine is going to be approved without going through a sequence of very closely monitored and strict clinical trials involving different groups of patients at each phase. So we're no different, right? Our medicines will need to prove safety, efficacy in each of those clinical trials. What we're doing is at our end in early stage drug discovery and development, we make use of as much data as we can, as is available to us, to make sure that the hypotheses are safe for patients.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it's only the clinical trial that answers this question.
Yeah. And speaking about the product features, are there any interesting design patterns that are unobvious that you can talk about?
There is a few. And I guess both of them involve data, because everything is like everything that we do is so close to how data is used. For the input side, we know that our users almost always want to understand what's going into an AI model, into an application that they're using to generate outputs that they use in their work. They want to know and see all the inputs that are being considered. So there's, you know, explainable AI is a big thing. It's definitely important to know the inputs, and it's almost always the case that these need to be clearly stated. But the way predictions, like, you know, the mechanics of how prediction is being made, that's of less importance.
Mm-hmm.
And the second kind of maybe unusual pattern is that in the biomedical context, our users always want to see more. And we're trying not to filter anything and assume what might be useful, what might not be useful from the user perspective. The default option from the design side would be to list everything that we know. That's our kind of main principle. Even the data that is missing, even the gaps in our knowledge of biomedical data, this might lead to experiences where, for some less studied areas, you know, users might be going through pages where there's nothing in the table. There is not much listed. So you have 10 or 20 fields and nothing in them. This is information for them. So lack of information is also information in certain contexts. And that's why we're not optimizing for fitting content to space. And so we have all real estate that we need, and we use it to display gaps and zeros and not availables.
Yeah, I think it's really unobvious, because normally people try to simplify, and in your case, it's a bit different story.
Yeah, I think elsewhere in consumer context, that might be considered as unnecessarily adding to noise. But in our case, this is the other way around. Removing the uncertainty around what we have at hand.
Again, more rich context. And I think I have time for only one more personal question.
Okay.
So in past year, what new habit or behavior has improved your work life?
Yeah, there is one thing that's been really important for me, because there's so many things that we can do as a company to get to our objectives. There are hundreds of possibilities, and they are all potentially good and correct things to focus on. So I've been asking this question to myself several times a day. So does this help us go faster? Is focusing on this thing going to help us go faster? Or is not going that route going to help us go faster? And this helped me prioritize my own efforts, prioritize the things that the team is doing, understand what's important, and also minimizing waste. So there's asking that question several times a day has been really helpful, changed my approach too. It's a good new habit. Does this help us go faster?
Yeah. I think even in such a complex product as Benevolent AI, it will still work because you again can test faster, get answers faster, get feedback faster, get new feature faster, and just close the loop faster. So it works everywhere. It's a great piece of advice.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for taking your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.